Tonight on Arena, Siobhan Cullen on her new Netflix comedy series, Bodkin, and new albums from Pet Shop Boys, St. Vincent, and Iron and Wine up for review. #51551 is the text. You can tweet the programme at RTE Arena. Next month, Netflix will unveil Bodkin, a darkly comedic thriller filmed amidst the picturesque landscapes of West Cork, Wicklow and Dublin. A motley crew of podcasters investigate the nefarious goings-on beneath the seemingly idyllic veneer of a small town in Ireland. Several mysterious disappearances occurred 25 years ago, and the series boasts an ensemble cast led by Siobhan Cullen, alongside the likes of Will Forte and Robin Cara. Siobhan has been busy of late, starring in The Dry alongside Roisin Gallagher and Ciarán Hinds, and Obituary, which we spoke to her about last year on the show. Delighted to be joined from Los Angeles this evening by Siobhan Cullen. First of all, Siobhan, congratulations on the IFTA Rising Star Award. I presume the Obituary, The Dry, and indeed the upcoming series Bodkin have all led into that. Must be nice to get that kind of recognition from your peers.
Yeah, it was such a lovely surprise. I totally wasn't expecting it. And to be, I suppose, in a room like that, sort of with those kind of people celebrating Irish TV and film, just even being in a room like that was very special. So to get the nod was kind of the icing on the cake.
Of course, you've been a rising star since the age of 8.
An overnight success, like 30 years in the making.
I know, well, I mean, obviously you were a very young actor. I think it was in The Abbey, wasn't it? In Marina Carr's Bog of Cats, I think, was your first stage appearance. But, you know, the Rising Star Award obviously doesn't go back quite that far. But I'm sure it also recognises, and for you, that grounding that you have in theatre, which started very young, but there obviously have been other successes in the meantime. How important has that been, do you think, to your screen successes?
Massively important. I didn't go to drama school, or I didn't train in the traditional sense. I studied drama and theatre in Trinity, which is, I suppose, a slightly more academic course with practical elements. But so I suppose the theatre was where I trained, really. So playing, you know, smaller parts once I graduated, you know, Maid number two and in plays in The Gate and The Abbey, and watching, you know, amazing Irish actors was how I suppose I learned my craft. So yeah, theatre is incredibly important to me, and I owe a lot to it and to the people who hired me back then.
Yeah, well, of course, you talk about Maid number two, etc. As we all know, the old adage, there's no such thing as a small part, there's only a small actor. And if you can play the small parts, then you can move on from those to other places. However, let us talk a little bit about Bodkin. I've seen the first episode of the series. How would you describe the character of Dove in this? She is no peacemaker, despite that name.
Yeah, to say the least. She's, I suppose, she's a hard-nosed investigative journalist who, when we meet her, is kind of going through a bit of a crisis in her career and her personal life. And she's been sent on this case to kind of lay low in the west of Ireland with two podcasters who are having the time of their lives. So there is a clash from the get-go, let's just say.
Yeah.
She can kind of see right through their enthusiasm and their joie de vivre, and she's having none of it.
She's having absolutely none of it. Let's have a listen, in fact. Let's have a listen to the moment when, I keep calling her Siobhan, when Dove arrives home, or arrives, they're in the London airport at this point, I think. And they're all sitting down, and you're meeting Will Forte, who is Gilbert Power, this world-famous podcast maker, and Emmy Cesare, played by Robin Cara.
But you know what's really sensational? Just listening to people tell their story. There's nothing more interesting.
Yeah, totally.
Right? The best stories are always mysteries. And there's only one true mystery. The human heart.
Wow. People will listen to that, will they?
Wait, Dove? Are you Dove? Oh my God, it's so nice to meet you. So Damien was telling me all about you.
Like what?
Good stuff. Yeah, good stuff. Do you know our researcher, Emmy?
I'm Emmy Souza. I work in the digital department. We've actually met a couple of times.
No, I don't think so.
Oh. So I've organized everything. Accommodation is sorted, interviews lined up. I've got maps. I've hired a driver for the week. Sean O'Shea. How Irish is that? I've actually been trying to learn Irish, which is a really difficult language.
Hey, this is going to be so much fun. Look at us, the dream team. Bodkin has no idea what's about to hit it.
There we go. Will Forte, Robin Cara and Siobhan Cullen. Actually, one of the things with that clip, Siobhan, is the dirty looks that she throws across at the two of them as they're talking there. But we get a sense of the sort of fun that's knocked around here. The Robin Cara as Emmy is so excited by the fact that the driver is called Sean O'Shea. I mean, Dove has no time for that, or indeed the way they kind of, when they get to the village of Bodkin, all they want is the tourist version of Ireland.
Exactly, yeah. They're very much seeing Ireland through rose-tinted glasses and the kind of postcard picture-perfect view. And I think Dove can see right through that.
It's one of the things that struck me about this, because as I say, I've seen the first episode. I haven't seen across the series just yet. But it has a mix in it of there's a dark theme in here. Something has happened 25 years ago, and it would seem that the entire community has closed in and it's not going to be spoken about. It's going to be very hard to get to the bottom of that. You have that darkness going on at one level, but also there's a lot of fun knocked out of the stereotypes that particularly Emmy, the researcher, and Gilbert, the podcaster, the stereotypes of Ireland that they just want to highlight and to share. That balance is a hard balance to strike.
Yeah, well, I think it's what drew me to, when I first read the script, it's what kind of caught my attention, was that you very much think you're watching something, and then the rug is kind of pulled from underneath you. We kind of straddle the line between comedy, thriller, mystery, and the audience, I think, is kind of kept on their toes. And it's that kind of genre mixing, I suppose, that I think is really unique. And then the tone is very important in Bodkin, for sure.
And, you know, it strikes me that there is a similarity in both Obituary and The Dry in that regard as well. Maybe even more so in The Dry, and we're about to get season two quite shortly. I know the screening of it for us guys is happening fairly soon, that initial press screening. That mix of the serious and the comic seems to be something that attracts you. Similarly, Elvira in Obituary, who, you know, makes herself loads of jobs by killing off people in her locality so that she can write an obituary for them in the local newspaper, which is, you know, going a bit far. But that kind of crossover seems to suit your style of comedy quite well. Did you know that all along, or is it something you've discovered through these series?
It's funny, I would never have considered myself a comic actress, but I suppose looking at my CV quite in the last few years, you might think otherwise. I was always drawn definitely more towards drama. That just sat more comfortably with me when I was, you know, a younger actor, I suppose. But I think that's the thing that, I don't know if it's a particularly unique thing to Irish people and the stories we tell, but I think comedy lies so closely to tragedy. It's a very fine line. So I think that kind of dark humour is something I think that comes quite naturally to Irish people, and to so yeah, I'm not sure if it's something that necessarily I'm drawn to or the project's come to me. Maybe it says something more about myself than anything else.
But I guess to have three things more or less on the screen, on the telly, at the same time, that's a phenomenal achievement. I know Obituary, I don't know if it's going to go to a second season, but I know Obituary isn't that long off the scene. The Dry will be on soon, and the Netflix series is going to be there soon. That that must feel pretty good.
Yeah, it's mad. I'm incredibly lucky. And look, it's either a feast or a famine. I've spent long enough waiting for the phone to ring as well. So there's definitely a good mix of both. But yeah, it's just it was really just a lucky thing that those three projects kind of came to me around the same time. It's amazing that we got to logistically work them all out, because at one point I think two of them were going to be shooting at the same time and I wasn't going to be able to do one. And anyway, we got there in the end. So yeah, it's been a busy couple of years.
Long may that continue for you. You know, I mentioned you mentioned earlier about, you know, when you were younger and you were in theatres watching established Irish actors and learning from watching them. You also had that experience recently in London. You worked with Ralph Fiennes on Straight Line Crazy. I love what one of the critics said about this. Siobhan Cullen easily matches and occasionally outperforms Fiennes in the acting stakes. That's a nice review.
That's a very kind review. I won't tell Rafe.
He might be listening. Hey, Rafe, come in and talk to us. but tell us a little bit about that experience. I mean, and for you to be sharing a stage with an actor of such renown, how difficult and how uplifting is something like that?
You know, it was a really amazing and surprising experience. I think going into it, I had misconceptions that, you know, this would very much be the Rafe show, like an A-lister. We're all just going to be there to support him and his performance. Mm. And it absolutely wasn't the case. He just cares about the story, and he is obsessive about the work. And he was totally open to playing every night, always looking for something new. He was just a really generous performer, and it was a total joy to kind of be on stage with him every night for however many months, 3 months or something. It was, a real privilege and a massive learning curve as well.
And also, you not only do you get big leading men like that in your theatre work, you get the big leading man that is Ciarán Hinds in The Dry. I mean, I'm sure that has been quite an experience to watch his way of working as well.
Oh, God, Ciarán is just the best. He's the best person to have on your cast, just because he's the loveliest human and also the most incredible actor. Yeah, it's a real treat to get to watch him work. He really is. I mean, everything you've heard about him is true. He's just incredible.
Yeah, well, what often strikes me about Ciarán Hinds is he plays these villainous characters, not necessarily in The Dry, but I suppose in lots of his theatre work and his other film work, you often get this villainous side to him, and there is nothing villainous about the man himself at all.
No, he's a total gentleman.
You're in LA at the moment, Siobhan. Is it primarily for Bodkin, for the press for Bodkin, or have you other plans afoot? And you can't say, I can't tell you anything.
No, that's it exactly. We have Bodkin, we have our premiere in a couple of days. So I'm out here for that and for press for Bodkin's release, yeah.
But when you smell the LA air, do you have any hankerings after it?
I'm rushing back home to Dublin to start a play in the Abbey. So,
all right. What's the next play that you're doing?
I'm doing a play in the Abbey called The Sugar Wife.
And who's the writer there?
That's by Elizabeth Cousy and directed by Annabel Common.
All right. And that will be coming. So you're coming home to start rehearsals pretty soon.
Exactly. Yeah. So no, I won't be lingering around here for too long.
Yeah. All right. Yeah. Well, I'm glad to hear that you'll be coming back to us, but would be equally glad to hear that you had huge successes ahead of you in LA. Siobhan, lovely to have spoken with you this evening. Congratulations on all of the recent work. Looking forward to seeing the play in the Abbey when it gets there. And congratulations
Thank you so much.
On that IFTA Rising Star Award. Thanks, Siobhan.
Thank you. Lovely chatting to you.
That's Siobhan Cullen. And all 7 episodes of Bodkin will premiere on Netflix on Thursday, May the 9th. May the 10th sees the release of the latest album from Villagers. It's called That Golden Time. Band, of course, first came to prominence in 2010 with the release of their debut album, Becoming a Jackal. The album went on to receive widespread critical acclaim, shortlisted for the Mercury Prize and the Choice Music Prize. Of course, Villagers went on to be nominated twice more for the Mercury Prize and to win the Choice Music Prize, as well as two Ivor Novello Awards. 2024 is certainly shaping up to be a special year. They have announced their biggest headline show to date at the Trinity Summer Series in Dublin on June the 29th. Before the album release and before that concert in Trinity, Conor O'Brien will be joining us live in Studio One in the RTE Radio Centre on Tuesday, May the 7th to launch the new album, That Golden Time. We would like you to be with us, and if you would like to come along on the night and join that studio audience, we have a limited number of tickets up for grabs. But to be in with a chance of being part of that audience, you need to send us your name, your number and your email, and you can text it to 51551 and we will announce, we will pass on the details and get the tickets to those who wish to have them. If you can't make it on the night, of course, we will be broadcasting our Villagers special show live here on RT Radio 1 at the usual time of 7 o'clock. 70 years ago, on this very day, in fact, April 26, 1954, a film premiered in Tokyo that has since gone on to become, without question, one of the most influential films ever made. Set in the 16th century, the story focuses on a group of peasants who are terrorised by marauding bandits and decide to hire a group of mercenaries for protection. We are, of course, talking about Seven Samurai, a film that has been remade many times in many forms, the most famous perhaps being as the Western, The Magnificent Seven, starring Stephen McQueen and Yul Brynner. Here with us this evening to discuss the film and its director, Akira Kurosawa, is film lecturer Stephen Benedict. You can't overstate the influence of Seven Samurai, Stephen.
No, I mean, it's been remade, as you said, quite a number of times as A Bug's Life. I mean, Pixar's movie, A Bug's Life. And putting aside Seven Samurai, Kurosawa himself made 30 films. 10 of them have been remade frequently since he was a filmmaker starting in the 40s and
50s. Bill Nye quite recently, isn't it?
I know, and I was going to hold that one to the end.
Well, we'll talk about it towards the end, yeah.
Yeah, yeah, but I mean, the thing is, if looking at Seven Samurai, you can draw a straight line between Seven Samurai and the modern-day action picture, because no less a filmmaker than George Lucas used Seven Samurai and the films of Akira Kurosawa as the template and the studying mechanism for his entire Star Wars saga. And then if you think beyond the Star Wars franchise itself into the DC Marvel spandex universes, then you can see and look at the way that they deliver their action. You can trace it all back to Seven Samurai. Because prior to Seven Samurai, action sequences arrived in short bursts.
Yeah, because everything you've mentioned there, we are talking high action movies.
Yes, it's sort of action and then a little bit of dialogue. Prior to Seven Samurai, it was the other way around. And when they did those short action sequences, they were usually shot by the second unit, by a director who was trying to work his way up the industry ladder. But Seven Samurai climaxes with a protracted battle that stretches out over almost the entire last hour of the film.
Wow.
Okay. And watching again on the big screen 2 years ago, I think it was 2 years ago in the IFI, I came away just thinking the only way I could describe it, it's a symphony of light and movement. That may sound pedantic, but...
And practically dialogue-less.
Yes, large stretches of it. And the thing is that comparing it to a symphony because Kurosawa divides the action up into movements with crescendos and diminuendos. And it's when you're looking at the they come in wave upon wave like a tsunami across the screen. So if you think about films such as the final shootout at the end of Bonnie and Clyde or The Wild Bunch, Indiana Jones, James Cameron and the Avatar Pictures, Mad Max, Transformers, Matrix, Lord of the Rings, they all owe it all to Seven Samurai.
Yeah, it all. You can trace it all right back to there. Okay, we'll come back to the specifics of the action sequences and all of that a bit later on. But you mentioned George Lucas in the midst of your chat there. Here is Lucas talking about he first came upon the films of the Japanese master.
I grew up in a small town, Central California, and the movie theaters there didn't show, much beyond The Blob. So I didn't really experienced foreign films until I found my way into film school. At that point is when I was actually exposed to Kurosawa. And after the first one I saw was Seven Samurai, and after that I was completely hooked. It's hard to really appreciate the true genius of Kurosawa, I think, until you've seen a few of the films and then you've been able to see other films at the same time and be able to realize his visual style. My favorite of all time is really Seven Samurai. It's really his visual style to me that is so strong and unique and a very, very powerful element in how he tells his stories. I think he comes from a generation of filmmakers that were still influenced by silent films, that the visual, the framing, and the quality of the images goes a long way to telling the story and setting the mood. And you're not going to find really a lot of filmmakers that have the facile quality with the medium that Kurosawa had.
And that's George Lucas there speaking about the influence of Akira Kurosawa on his work. And interesting, Stephen Benedict with me speaking about Kurosawa and specifically The Seven Samurai this evening, 70 years old on this very day, that film. He talked about there, Lucas, about silent films.
Yes.
Silent films are particularly important in Japanese film culture for reasons that we mightn't think of straight away.
Yeah, compared to the American cinema. American cinema transitioned to sound in 1927, but the Japanese silent cinema extended far beyond that, deep into the 1930s. And the thing is that Kurosawa himself was born in 1910. So do the maths.
Yeah.
He was watching silent cinema all the way through his 20s.
Which is, I suppose, the most formative time for many filmmakers,
exactly.
Really, isn't it?
Now, and in addition to that, the tradition of silent cinema extended so far into Japanese cinema that they actually created a person who would stand beside the screen called a benshi, B-E-N-S-H-I, and they would narrate the pictures, and they would provide the dialogue. Now, that tradition is borrowed from the kabuki theatre in Japanese theatre.
And would that kind of replace, I suppose, the tradition in Western culture is that you had the big organ coming up out of the ground, or the piano player?
Yes, the narration of it. Yeah, so music would be the narration. But here's the really, really important thing. Akira Kurosawa's older brother, Heigo, was a benshi, and a really, really famous one at that. So that was another reason that was one of the reasons why young Akira would go to the movies, because his brother was working in it. But another important point to make here is that Kurosawa himself didn't set out to be a filmmaker. His initial ambition was to be a painter. And he was remarkably gifted with the brush from a very early age. In actual fact, he had his first professional exhibition while he was still in his teens. But because his brother was working in the movies, literally in the cinema, Akira Kurosawa drifted into the cinema and then quite literally brought his canvases to life on screen. Because here's the thing, Sean. Kurosawa not only directed 30 films, he wrote the scripts for all of those films, whether they were adaptations or not. Mm. In addition to that, he storyboarded each and every single one of them because of his painting background.
He's capable of drawing and painting in that regard.
Yeah, and this remarkable visual flair. But the final kicker about Akira Kurosawa is, and this is what elevates him above almost every other filmmaker in the history of the art, he edited his own films as well. So he wrote the screenplays, he storyboarded each picture, and then he edited. So he knew when he was doing each shot where it was going to go. It's almost like a composer, and I'm going back to the music again, it's like a composer knowing where the note is going to go next.
But one of the things that strike me, I mean, as you describe, even as you speak about him there, it's clear that he was absolutely steeped, Kurosawa, in Japanese culture.
Yes, very.
How unusual is it for somebody coming from that particular, you know, high art background in many ways to then have such an influence on Western pop culture?
Well, it's interesting because the Japanese critics didn't regard Kurosawa so highly. There was two other major filmmakers at the time, Yasujirō Ozu and Kenji Mitsuguchi. And they were held in greater esteem by the Japanese filmmakers. It was in the West that Kurosawa was held in greater esteem.
And why do you think that was?
I think, well, in terms of terms specifically about Seven Samurai, the themes are really, really universal. It's a story about injustice. It's a story about a group of small peasants in a village being marauded upon by a group of bandits who are coming in and stealing their food. So their livelihoods are at stake. It's about economic exploitation. It's about theft and intimidation. And then if you think about the samurai themselves, they're recruited, for want of a better word, by the villagers. And the odds that these samurai face are enormous. There's seven of them against over 50 bandits, and they take them on, showing incredible courage and sacrifice. And I think in that respect, it shows how old the story is, because in Western terms, in Christian terms, you can trace it to the Bible. And it's the story in the book of Samuel with David versus Goliath. It's the little guy taking on the big giant. And then finally, if you think about it, you can look at it in filmmaking terms, because Akira Kurosawa is the villager, is the peasant taking on the critics. Because at the time, Seven Samurai was the most expensive movie to date ever made in Japan. And he came under enormous pressure and criticism for making such an expensive film.
We have a clip here, one of his final pictures. Did he make many films in English?
None. You're going to hear the clip that we have is one of the most exclusive clips in English that he ever had in his films.
Right, okay. And it's a 1990 film called Dreams, which is a series of episodes based on a series of recurring dreams that Kurosawa himself had throughout his life. Vincent van Gogh is one of the artists, and there's the painting is there again.
Yes.
He comes across, or this is a character who appears in his dreams. I'm not going to say who is acting the part here. My hint to the listeners at home, you might think of this person more as a director than you would than as an actor. But here is that director playing the part of Van Gogh.
A scene that looks like a painting does not make a painting. If you take the time and look closely, all of nature has its own beauty. And when that natural beauty is there, I just lose myself in it. And then, as if it's in a dream, the scene just paints itself for me. Yes, I consume this natural setting. I devour it completely and whole. And then when I'm through, the picture appears before me complete. But it's so difficult to hold it inside.
Then what do you do?
I work, I slave, I drive myself like a locomotive.
Did you guess who the director was? The part of actor there, Martin Scorsese, in the 1990 film Dreams. Interesting, that last line. I drive myself like a locomotive. Could be Scorsese talking about his own filmmaking, couldn't it?
I think that's a beautiful layer of it because, you know, it's Kurosawa's dreaming of Van Gogh, who's a Western painter. And then this is his... what drives him as an artist. So he puts Scorsese as an artist, as a director, in his own dream, which I think is a beautiful layer.
Is there anything significant in the fact that the artist that Kurosawa chooses to give us in this particular set of dreams is Van Gogh, and that Van Gogh was a recurring dream for him?
Yeah, I think so, because if you think about specifically, you know, the outdoor scenes, the outdoor paintings that Van Gogh specialised in, and the outdoor is a really, really important element in Kurosawa's films. I would contend that Kurosawa was one of the very, very few film directors who was as comfortable indoors as he was outdoors. He was comfortable with a window and a door as he was with a horizon and the sky. Very, very few film directors are comfortable in both arenas. And the reason I think for that is because, you know, the elements play a really, really important part in Kurosawa's films, especially the rain, especially the snow and the dust. They're constantly swirling around the frame and just, you know, giving you the impression that there's movement within the frame even when there isn't. And so when we have the snow and the dust swirling around the characters, it's to show their emotional turmoil. But the thing is, if you think about Seven Samurai, the final battle takes place in a torrential downpour. It's so relentless that the samurai and the bandits are actually not only fighting each other, they're fighting the nature itself. And then you realise what Kurosawa is doing.
Let's listen to a final clip, which is Coppola.
Ah, okay.
Yeah, I mean, with the three of the very big filmmakers there, American filmmakers.
Coppola, Scorsese,
and Lucas, you know. Yeah. But here's Francis Ford Coppola, and he is, of course, going to mention his great movie.
I can remember in the 50s, there was the beginning of an art house movement in the suburbs of New York, where I was raised on Long Island. And that's where I first saw many of the films coming from around the world. And of course, with Kurosawa, the first films I remember seeing were the samurai pictures. Violence was depicted in almost a poetic, surprising way that seemed to stem from those moments which startled you. And that became a style, I would say, originating from Kurosawa through certainly Peckinpah, but Bonnie and Clyde, my own film, The Godfather. I think you could trace a line backwards from The Godfather to Bonnie and Clyde to Kurosawa.
There you go, Francis Ford Coppola there on his particular attachment to Kurosawa. Did he bail him out? Did he bail Kurosawa out at some point along
well,
the way?
Well, he certainly helped with the financing of his masterpiece, one of his masterpieces, Kagemusha, which won the Palme d'Or at the Cannes Film Festival in 1980. It was returned to form after Kurosawa had a very, very dark period in his life, attempting to take his own life. through a series of personal disasters and artistic disasters. But the thing about Kurosawa, we've got to note, just for the audiences who may not have seen his films, he didn't only specialise in samurai pictures. He specialised in many different genres, crime pictures, for example, and even Shakespeare adaptations. He did two masterful adaptations, Macbeth, which he turned into Throne of Blood, and then King Lear, which he turned into Ran, which translates as chaos. But he also did incredibly tender dramas. And I would contend that his greatest picture is the one that you mentioned at the beginning. It's a movie called Ikiru, and it's about a guy who spent his entire adult working life dedicated to a bureaucratic program to the point that he wonders what's the meaning in his life. And then he's diagnosed with terminal cancer, and then he dedicates the rest of his life. His legacy will be the creation of a children's playground.
Yeah.
It sounds maudlin, but it's an incredible film. It was remade last year.
Yeah, Bill Nye, Living it's called, Living, I was asking you that.
But if you can, Living has its virtues, but if you look at Akira Kurosawa's original, that is an emotional tsunami.
Right, an emotional tsunami indeed. Akira, if you want to watch that, that's Stephen Benedict talking to us about Kurosawa in general, Seven Samurai, released 70 years ago this very day. And Stephen, just before you go, I know that you'd like to be join with us in taking a moment to acknowledge Greta Price Martin, a student at your own college, IIDT, who of course lost her life so tragically yesterday. Our thoughts and condolences to her family and friends, and indeed all at IIDT. And so to our album reviews, new releases from the electropop stalwarts Pet Shop Boys, 40 years since the release of their massive hit West End Girls. 15th studio album is out, it's called Nonetheless. St. Vincent, also known as Annie Clark, returns with her latest album, All Born Screaming. Some reviews have already called it her best album yet. Is that what we're going to hear this evening? And Light Verse comes from Iron and Wine, also known as Sam Bean, the American songwriter operating as Iron and Wine, a revolving cast of collaborators. It's his first full-length release in 7 years. Delighted to be joined in studio this evening by Paul McLoone and Kelly Ann Byrne. And we're going to start with the Pet Shop Boys, and the opening track from their album, Loneliness. Very atmospheric opening. Where are you going to run to now out of loneliness? Who are you going to turn to out of loneliness? Opening track on the new Pet Shop Boys album, which is called Nonetheless. Very atmospheric opening, as I said, Kelly Ann Byrne. And I thought, are we into a totally new place with Pet Shop Boys? And then in came the beat, and I thought, I know we're still going to be dancing, but we're dancing to quite dark lyrics.
Yeah, I was just saying that to Paul, that track. Mm. Like, you want to jump on the dance floor with the melody, and then...
Then you listen.
Typical Pet Shop Boys, it's quite melancholic. That's their magic, I think. They just have the ability to be euphoric, cathartic and melancholic at the same time.
Yeah, 100%. It's their kind of secret weapon, really. I mean, they're not the only band who've done it.
Yeah, I suppose the pop song is made up of essentially sad themes, but happy tunes.
Yeah, but Pet Shop Boys managed to elevate it to this kind of, especially when you see them live or hear their you know, music in a kind of a club. So not that I'm much of a visitor to the clubs these days, but when you hear that kind of, when you're in that place where it's where there's a mass gathering, put it that way, there's this kind of euphoric thing that sets in with them as well. You know, so it's melancholy, but it's uplifting. It's that sad, happy thing. And they just do it on a grand scale. Like what a lot of their music has been over the years has just been more, bigger, huge kind of sounds or whatever. Yeah. And they've done the minimalist stuff as well. But I think they're at their best when they do this kind of record, is sort of a lush, well-produced, polished kind of sheen to it. You know, that sort of beautiful, smooth and great tunes and a wonderful, that wonderful tension between the melancholy and the dance thing. It's really hard to do, and they do it, they make it seem easy, but they do it very well.
Neil Tennant, his voice.
Oh my God.
It's extraordinary listening to it. He sounds like he's 25.
He does, and he sounds like that live. And actually, I watched...
You saw him twice this year live,
I've seen them twice. I saw them with my dad in Three Arena last summer.
You were at that gig too,
yeah.
Paul?
I was, an amazing show. God, unbelievable.
And then with New Order in New York. And both times, his voice is incredible. But I was watching a Q&A with The Guardian on Monday, and he takes singing lessons still. And you can tell.
Yeah, well, it's clear
just hits
as a
the
bell.
Notes. Yeah.
Yeah, I thought he'd been working on it. I suspect that he was working on it.
But the other thing is, I think, did he refer to this as their most queer album yet?
Yeah, he referred to it as the most queer album. There's a couple of tracks that are dedicated to gay icons. The last track, is dedicated to Oscar Wilde.
Love is the Law.
Love is the Law, yeah. And it's about Oscar Wilde cruising on the promenade des Anglais in Nice after being released from prison. And then you've got Dancing Star, which is a beautiful track, kind of like West End Girls.
Yeah.
Yeah, about the...
Rudolf Nureyev.
Yeah.
Yes.
Yeah.
A great video for that. I don't know if you've seen the video.
Oh, it's beautiful.
Yeah, black and white shots of Nureyev dancing around the place. Yeah. It's just extraordinary stuff.
And it's very typical of Neil Tennant lyrically as well. Okay, he may have gone for it a little more with this record in terms of an overarching theme, but he does, on every Pet Shop Boys record or on a lot of them, there's been this little foray into the historical, you know?
He'll
do this little historical kind of song with its roots in an actual historical event. So, yeah, why not?
He gives us the biography of Nureyev. Yeah. And jumping, his moving away from the Soviet Union.
And Tennant has a fascination with the Soviet era, I think, as well. So it wasn't all that surprised to see that pop up, no pun intended. But he makes a great pop song out of it, of course.
Yeah, but there's also a little bit of nostalgia and even a bit of regret on this, I would say. Let's have a listen to a bit of A New Bohemia. I wish I lived my life free and easier.
I said to Paul, when I listened, I wish I lived my life free and easier.
Yeah, but
and I said.
And he said, are you for real, Kellyanne? No one's free or easier
Keep it for yourselves, that one. But I really did get a sense of regret in all of that.
Yeah.
Oh, absolutely. And it's a wonderful, that opening line where he says, where you're sort of feeling out of place in a younger place now.
Yes.
And it's like being a silent, whatever the lyric is. Of course, he puts it much better than me, but he equates it with being like a silent movie star after the talkies in Hollywood, you know. And it's a great way of just nailing that out of place feeling, a man out of time, a man in the wrong place, sort of harken back to a youth that's gone.
Stars from you on this one, Paul.
I didn't write it down. I neglected to write it down, but I think we've got to go four. We've got to go four because there's one song on it that I think isn't quite up to scratch.
All right.
Schlager?
That's the one.
That's the one I thought.
I'm
going to go four. Yeah. But it's stunning.
Pretty solid four from both of you there for nonetheless. Let us move on to St. Vincent, also known as Annie Clark, returns with her latest album called Orn, All Born Screaming. Was it Reckless or Broken Man that was the standout for you on this one?
Actually, both of them. I would have said probably Reckless more. It's a track I think really showcases her production. It's her first time self-producing.
Your wish is my command.
Oh, great.
There we go. Reckless, second track on the new album from St. Vincent, which is the new album is called All Born Screaming. Post-plague pop is...
What?
Is that her term?
That's her term.
Really?
Post-plague pop record. Mm. I guess there's a lot of bands and artists, understandably, Iron and Wine, who will come to sort of reflecting on and having been affected by, in various ways, creatively and less so, the pandemic. So I guess it's an allusion to that. I love hearing that song on its own now because it sounds great on its own.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I just think it's a little too early on the album.
Yeah,
that's
what I was saying. It's the second track. And you were saying the opening three tracks, you'd have sequenced the album slightly differently.
I'd have done it, I'd have put a couple of the bangers up front. Mm-hmm. But I'm old-fashioned that way. Bangers off the front.
I loved the slow burner.
I'm wondering, is this classic St. Vincent who, you know, she's producing it herself, number one, which is courageous.
Yeah.
But she'll also just do...
Whatever she wants.
She'll take a risk on anything.
Well, that's it. She'll do whatever she wants. And I think what I loved about the production on this record was tracks change midway through. The beginning is very, very different to the end. She completely surprises you the whole way through. It's unpredictable in a brilliant way and you will never, ever get bored listening to it. Like that track that you just played totally changes about 5 seconds after what we just heard.
Yeah.
It almost comes in like An Army of Me by Bjork.
Yeah.
And so I thought it was stunningly produced.
Yeah, across 4 minutes, she does quite a lot. Let's have a little bit of a listen to Broken Man, in fact, because Dave Grohl's on the drums.
Of course he is.
I just wanted to wait there until it got to the drums. Paul, I knew you really wanted to hear Dave Grohl's drumming.
Not wrong with his drumming.
One of the greatest days of my life, said St. Vincent about working with Dave Grohl on this album.
Well, he's a lovely guy.
So it's the guy.
He's a fab drummer.
He's a fab drummer, okay.
He's just a little overly ubiquitous at times.
All right.
The inevitable Dave Grohl, you should call.
Something interesting about this record is I was watching her on Instagram. She had a chest infection when she recorded the vocal. Yeah. So she was kind of doing this in the studio. And I love the fact that she left it all in because it kind of adds to that rawness.
Well, that broken man kind of theme that she's talking about.
She's talking about herself, by the way.
Yeah. I would think it has that autobiographical feel of it. Does she manage then, despite the fact that she got the sequencing wrong for you, Paul? Does she manage to pull the album together?
Oh, I think so. I mean, I listened to it a couple of times, and it a lot of it is a bit growy, to be fair. Like a lot of great music for me, and definitely hearing those tracks now in isolation, they sound completely different to listening to the whole thing in sequence. Mm. So I'll go back again and probably I'll be reinformed by that perception now. But I think on second or third listen, I still had a sense that the album for me got into its kind of gear a bit later on, after about a third of the way through. I think it gets really strong from that point on, and it finishes very strongly with the title track. And there's a little surprise as well towards the end with the
reggae
surprising reggae song, So Many Planets, which is great. And I thought, well, again, in my old-fashioned way, I'm kind of thinking, don't bury that at the end of the album, you know? Yeah. But, you know.
What does a growy album get in Stars terms?
I'd say 3.5. I was going to say 3, but that's a little mean.
Okay, 3.5. And then that might
may well go to 4.
A growy star rating as well.
If the sun keeps shining.
Yeah.
I gave it 4. I thought it was outstanding.
Well, she takes the risk of starting dark and bringing us to brightness at the end.
Mm. Yeah.
So you said 4.
Kelly. I gave it 4, yeah.
All right, 4 for... It's pretty solid so far. That's All Born Screaming from St. Vincent. Let's move on then to Light Verse from Iron and Wine. This is a track called All in Good Time, featuring not only Iron and Wine, by Corona Sambeam, but Fiona Apple. All in Good Time from Iron and Wine and Light Verse. And Sam Beam, as in Iron and Wine, that's his real name is Sam Beam, Iron and Wine.
Yeah. I think he took his name from a diet supplement or something, Iron
and Wine. I'll
tell you
what, if I was called Sam Beam, I'd be Sam Beam.
So would I.
I'm Sam, Mr. Beam to you.
Yeah. But he had real difficulties. Paul touched on this earlier. He had real difficulties with lockdown. You know, for some, it was a really highly creative period. For him, it was total block.
Yeah, he was crippled. He's talked about that. He basically said that every time he tried to sit down and write something, just the anxiety and the fear around the pandemic, that was all clouding it. But the thing is, when he did sit down to create this record, in a way it did influence it because he ended up writing something that kind of is a celebration of life. It's quite a positive record.
Yeah.
And I think that was influenced by the fact that he said himself and his family came out of the pandemic unscathed.
Yeah.
And so it gave him an appreciation of things, like all of us.
Yeah. Yeah. I suppose that is that he took the positive after the event.
Yes,
he couldn't see it at the time, and that's fair enough. Dolly Parton and Kenny Rogers, there's a touch of that.
Absolutely.
Him
and it is a hugely positive and upbeat kind of record, you know. Yeah. I don't know why, it just isn't what I was expecting, but I'm delighted that it is so. And never in a kind of a corny or kind of cloying kind of way. But that song particularly illustrates, he's a clever kind of songwriter because it's called All in Good Time, but instead of the all in good time that you'd expect that to mean, oh, well, all good things will happen all in good time. They've had the all in good time has happened.
It's gone, yeah.
They're at the end of the relationship. But even within that, it's not a bitter song. It's not a kind of a sort of a twisted sort of, well, I was betrayed by you. They're kind of upbeat about it in a sort of slightly resigned but not entirely kind of negative way, you know. I just think it's a very clever song. It's a very clever twist on that idea, and with the duet as well, it's a clever duet.
And I know
a brilliant choice of collaborator.
Yeah, and you've both mentioned Simon and Garfunkel, you've both mentioned Nick Drake. And you've both mentioned the Beatles. I mean, I suppose every singer-songwriter, every song that has ever existed is probably influenced by those three people. But you're I think you're elevating Sam Beam into that company.
Yeah, I think so. There's a track on, I don't know if you're going to play something from, but there's a track on it called Taken by Surprise, which I thought was the best song on the album. And it sounds like Nick Drake's greatest work. But something Paul was talking about looking back and not being bitter on that particular track, he seems to be looking back at a toxic relationship, and he's saying, if you came back again, I wouldn't be taken by surprise. I'm older now and it bounces off me. And I just thought that was so beautifully done.
Wise without being bitter.
Wise without being bitter, exactly.
Stars from you on this one, Kellyanne.
It was a 4 for me. I loved this record.
And what are you saying overall, Paul, and stars?
Absolutely straightforward. Beautiful record. Beautifully produced, by the way, as well. And the string arrangements and everything. Just wonderfully well crafted, beautifully put together record with great songs. Yeah, absolutely 4 out of 5.
3.5s and 4s all the way from Kellyanne Byrne and Paul McLean. Good week at the listening desk. Nonetheless, from Pet Shop Boys, All Born Screaming from St. Vincent, and Light Verse from Iron and Wine, bringing this week's Arena to a close. Niall Fitzmaurice and Liam Murphy researched. David Phelan was the broadcast coordinator. James Feeney was on sound this evening. Tonight's programme produced by Reg Luby.